In general, I think it's safe to say that we're not going to be in a robust budget environment.
The end of the line for a long building spree at the University of Alaska Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, December 6th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the effective wildlife education program at Sitka's Fortress of the Bear.
The bears ran straight over to the tents, split them open, pulled the sleeping bags out, and the kids were like, "I'm never taking food in my tent again."
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
The Division of Elections has rejected a petition calling for the recall of Representative Lindsey Holmes. While the recall group exceeded the number of signatures required by the state, state attorneys weren't compelled by their legal reasoning for removing Holmes from office. The group needed to prove that Holmes showed a, quote, lack of fitness for office. They argued that Holmes violated a compact with voters when she changed her party affiliation to Republican not long after her election. The recall group plans to file an appeal of the decision, but there has never been a successful recall of an Alaska politician. Representative Bob Herron is being fined for ethics violations dating back to when he was first elected to the legislature in 2009. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports.
The House Ethics Committee found that Herron knowingly withheld, quote, sufficient detail, end quote, on his business ventures with another legislator, Senator Lyman Hoffman. Herron and Hoffman both represent Western Alaska, and they co-own a school bus company in the Bethel area. Golden Eagle Unlimited has a $930,000 contract with the Lower Kuskokwim School District to transport students. According to ethics law, anytime a legislator has a contract with a state that's worth more than $5,000, they have to report it. The school district is considered a unit of the state. The Ethics Board ruled that Herron knowingly left the contract out of his financial disclosures. The Senate Ethics Committee made a similar ruling on Herron's business partner, Senator Hoffman, in November. The House Ethics Board spent the past year digging through Herron's financial filings and conducting interviews. They found that Herron also failed to report the seats he held on the boards of corporations since he was elected. But the Ethics Committee dismissed two other complaints against him. Herron was in Unalaska this week to attend a community event and hold a public listening session at his legislative office. He declined to comment on his ethics violations, but Herron did hand off a written statement to KUCB. It read, quote, "I have never knowingly filed a false, misleading, or incomplete disclosure statement," end quote. The statement went on to say that Herron will comply with the corrective actions the committee laid out and follow the financial filing requirements. In all, Herron will be fined about $15,000 for the violations by the House Ethics Committee and the Alaska Public Offices Commission. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
A national commission blames the state of Alaska for the epidemic of violence afflicting Alaska Natives and has come up with a series of recommendations to strengthen tribal jurisdiction. The state attorney general agrees there's a public safety problem, but says the commission's solutions aren't suited to Alaska. KNBA's Jocelyn Estes reports.
The Indian Law and Order Commission is recommending changes to federal laws and regulations and a change in the state of Alaska's approach to give tribes greater authority to handle crime. But Alaska Attorney General Michael Garrity says the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act abolished Indian country in Alaska, and resurrecting it would leave non-natives in predominantly native villages with no say in self-governance.
Now, if those communities become Indian country, and the commission is successful in its recommendations, then what happens to those people who may have lived in those communities? They may have raised their kids there. They may own land there. They may have, you know, their parents could have been born there. What happens to those people? How do they participate in the self-government of Indian country in that particular community?
Commission Chair Troy Ide, former U.S. Attorney for the District of Colorado, says under federal law, tribal courts are required to protect constitutional rights, including due process, and tribal jurisdiction over crime affecting tribal members is no different from him having to abide by local laws, even though, as a Colorado resident, he doesn't get to vote locally.
Mr. Ide's hypothetical is off base.
Garrity says the commission is viewing Alaska's villages through the lens of the Lower 48 reservation system, where citizens entering the reservation understand they will be subject to tribal law. But he says Alaskans are free to live in any Alaskan community and expect to have a say in electing leaders and voting on laws that will govern them.
But how do they participate in a government, in a community where they have no rights to vote or to have a say in what goes on in the laws that are passed or anything like that?
Instead, Garrity says the Department of Law has drafted a template memorandum of understanding to allow tribes to address violations of certain state laws through tribal courts. He says the state is meeting with the Tanana Chiefs Conference, a regional nonprofit for Interior Alaska, where dozens of tribes operate courts, to negotiate the terms of the MOU, which would deputize tribal officers to enforce state laws dealing with domestic violence and alcohol-related misdemeanors.
To a local tribunal or a program for them to deal with it right there in the community and without going through the state system. You know, deal with it very quickly there in the community or the village with a culturally relevant remedy, whatever they choose. But, it's something for them, an option for them to use. So this MOU kind of sets out the framework of how that would work.
Garrity says the state is also working on a pilot program on St. Paul Island in the Pribilofs to divert juvenile cases to local programs, a project the state hopes will serve as a model for other communities across Alaska. Garrity says the Parnell administration's goal is to provide a village public safety officer, or VPSO, to every community that wants one. He says the state is seeing some success in reaching that goal. There were fewer than 50 VPSOs in 2007, and as of August of this year, there were more than 100. Garrity says the Department of Public Safety is also working to get VPSOs armed so they can more effectively and safely respond to dangerous, volatile situations.
For some time, they've been looking at and working on regulations to allow VPSOs who've been through training and have the appropriate certifications to arm themselves. And those regulations have now been promulgated and they're out for public comment.
The commission also said an amendment to the Violence Against Women Act that excluded Alaska from provisions that allow tribes to enforce protective orders and prosecute offenders is unconscionable. But Garrity says the state lobbied for the exemption because Alaska tribes don't have a land base over which they exercise sovereignty, so those provisions would not work in Alaska. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
The final piece of steel in the University of Alaska Anchorage's new engineering building was put into place today. It marks the beginning of the end for a decade of vast expansion at the university. APRN's Josh Edge has more.
A light drizzle fell in the audience as a crane lifted the final piece of steel to the top of the four-story structure. The Christmas tree-clad beam, adorned with signatures of most of the onlookers, slid smoothly into place with the help of a couple iron workers. The new engineering and industry building will provide some much-needed space for a program that's expanded by 1,000 students since the year 2000. According to Chris Terlides, the Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities and Campus Services at UAA, the $78 million building's new labs and classrooms will be unusual.
We build in the building with a theme of engineering on display, so you'd be able to see from other parts of the building what's going on in the labs and what's going on in some of the classrooms.
The building is a piece of a three-part project, which also includes renovating and updating the current engineering building and adding a parking garage. This project is the latest and likely the last in a busy decade of expansion at UAA, which has seen the expansion of the school's library, the construction of the new Health Science Building, ConocoPhillips Science Building, and the Alaska Airlines Sports Center, and a few other projects. But with the school anticipating decreasing state funding in the future, the trend of expansion isn't likely to continue.
In general, I think it's safe to say that we're not going to be in a robust budget environment over the next few years.
That's UAA Chancellor Tom Case.
So right now the emphasis is on finishing up those things that have gotten started, do the deferred maintenance that we can, because delaying deferred maintenance just adds to the problem in future years.
Also on the docket are upgrades for the older buildings on campus, some of which are approaching the half-century mark. The Engineering and Industry Building is expected to be complete before the start of the fall 2015 semester. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, biologists pinpoint the culprit in a bird die-off in western Alaska.
The unusual thing is that avian cholera had not been detected in Alaska before. It had been found in Canada.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Late last month, residents of St. Lawrence Island began finding hundreds of dead seabirds. This week, state officials said the event was from a common disease and is no cause for concern. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports.
On Wednesday, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game said in a press release that tests showed the birds died from avian cholera, which is a lot less terrifying than it sounds.
Avian cholera is not related to the disease cholera that affects humans. It is only a disease of birds. It's relatively common around the rest of the world. The unusual thing is that avian cholera had not been detected in Alaska before. It had been found in Canada, but this is the first time we found it in Alaska.
Kathy Harms is a wildlife biologist with ADF&G. She says even with a large die-off like the one recently seen on St. Lawrence Island, it's a relatively natural event.
We had heard that people had concerns of why birds were dying and appearing on the beach. The good news is, although those birds died, it's not something that can hurt people, and it isn't related to the environment or other issues. It is just an outbreak. These outbreaks tend to run their course in a relatively short period of time, and in fact, we are hearing fewer reports of dead birds as the days go on.
The Department of Fish and Game recommends putting the carcasses in a vented metal oil drum. That way they can decompose without causing any more illness to spread to scavengers or other animals. For KNOM in Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
A deadly virus transmitted by ticks is on the rise, and researchers are studying its prevalence in Alaska. The Centers for Disease Control recently published a study on the Powassan virus in the western United States and Siberia. Anna Rose MacArthur reports from KNOM in Nome.
The virus is usually found in the eastern U.S. and Canada, but since the 1950s, a growing number of isolated cases have been reported in the West. And in the past two decades, diagnoses have more than doubled, catching the attention of the medical community nationwide. This recent study intended to map the range of the virus in the West. To do that, researchers tested wild animals of the region. Animals host the virus, and ticks transmit the contagion. It spreads by a tick biting an infected animal, and later a subsequent tick biting that same animal and becoming infected, continuing the cycle. Eleanor Deerdorf, postdoctoral researcher at the University of New Mexico and lead writer on the study, said to plot the virus, scientists collected fluid samples from 600 animals across Alaska, Siberia, and New Mexico.
Pretty much everything we could get our hands on, all kinds of different animals. There were voles, there were mice, there were squirrels.
What they found is that 6% of the Myotis voles in south central Alaska and in Siberia contain antibodies to the virus. A closely related vole in southeastern Alaska also showed reactivity, and in New Mexico, mice carried the antibodies. All these animals displayed signs of having been infected, which means, Deerdorf says, if each individual animal of these species can carry this virus, Then from New Mexico all the way through the western U.S., across Alaska and into Siberia, live potential hosts for perpetuating this infection. Deardorff says at this point, researchers cannot tell if the virus's range is spreading, and if it is, if that expansion is due to climate change.
If it is spreading, then it will most likely be as tick range expands, and that could well be influenced by climate change. But this study is not robust enough to make any kind of conclusions about spread.
Researchers are currently mapping the genetic sequence of the collected antibodies. This data will reveal if the infection is indeed Powassan virus or if it is an undocumented virus. Reporting from Nome, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
The controversial Ambler Road was the focus of the Western Arctic Caribou Herd Working Group meeting in Anchorage yesterday. KNOM's Lorelei Kinnean reports.
The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority is planning to build the road to Nova Copper's mining claims in the Ambler Mining District. The road is part of Governor Sean Parnell's Road to Resources program, and the permitting process is slated to begin early next year, in a few months. The Caribou Herd Working Group got an update from ADA on where they are in the process of developing the private industrial road. ADA's Ambler Access Program Manager, Mary Ellen Tuttle, said they plan on beginning the environmental review process soon. As of now, ADA has put together a proposal.
Once we submit this proposal to the federal agencies, there will be an entirely new team of environmental people looking at the alternative we propose and looking at the potential environmental and social impacts.
A number of working group members and members of the public voiced their opposition to the Ambler Road project directly to Tuttle and the road developers, along with John Moeller, the governor's rural affairs advisor. Naturally, this being the Western Arctic Herd meeting, many concerns were in regards to the caribou herd's migration. The proposed road runs directly perpendicular to the path caribou take to their wintering grounds. Virginia Comack from Ambler addressed the working group and federal representatives who support and advise the working group in decision-making and various federal processes. Comack said her tribe expects to sit down with every federal agency regarding any sort of planning on their ancestral land and water rights areas.
And the very area where the land proposal for the mining and the explorations done are all our traditional lands, waters of our Kuvamni people, the biggest, largest nation in the whole Northwest Alaska.
Pollock Simon Sr. from Allakaket is a member of the working group. He says his community, along with those around him, will be greatly impacted by the proposed 225-mile road to Ambler from the Dalton Highway.
There's lots to talk about, lots to be worried about.
The road to Ambler and Nova Copper's mine go hand in hand. Neither project will be developed without the other. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Lorelei Kinnean.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka, Chugiak, Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon, Wrangell, Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Robert Woolsey. This week on AK, Bear Care. You may have heard of the Fortress of the Bear in Sitka. The Bear Rescue Center was founded in 2003 in a storm of controversy. 10 years later, it's home to five brown bears and two new black bear cubs, and it has made some converts, including an influential local biologist. KCAW's Rachel Waltholz reports.
Les Kinnear may sound like he's talking to a toddler.
Boy, put your foot here. Foot. Baloo, foot. Foot. You're not paying attention.
Baloo. But Baloo is an 800-pound brown bear.
What? No? Okay.
Kinnear runs Sitka's Fortress of the Bear with his wife, Evie. He's standing nose to snout with Baloo, a 4-year-old, 7-foot-tall brown bear, separated by only a couple inches and a metal grate door. Kinnear was a hunting guide for years, hunting bears along with other big game. Now, he and his wife care for 7 bears in the remains of Sitka's old pulp mill. The bears were all orphaned as cubs and would otherwise have been euthanized. Asked why he started the fortress, Kinnear says,
"Well, all you gotta do is have one of those little bears sit there and lick you on the hand, and you know the answer to that one. That's simple."
The 2 giant clarifying tanks from the old pulp mill have been converted into large bear pens with high concrete walls.
It has kind of a post-apocalyptic feel in here.
Yeah.
It's not just the bear pens. All the facilities buildings were salvaged from the pulp mill or hauled over secondhand. Everything is rusty. There are piles of tires, sacks of supplies. A flock of assorted poultry roams around. It's a scrappy operation. When the fortress was first proposed, a lot of Sitkins weren't thrilled.
We have one of the largest or the highest known density of brown bears in the world. In the world. And so people are saying, why would you put a zoo in here? That's a good question.
Phil Mooney is the regional wildlife biologist for the Department of Fish and Game. He was skeptical at first. And he wasn't the only one.
Letters went to the governor. It was pretty divisive in the beginning. There was a big campaign to keep our bears wild and that type deal, and that people come here to see wild bears, not zoo bears. And there was a lot of, a very strong emotional response.
But Mooney has since changed his mind. He remembers a delegation visiting from the Bronx Zoo. One of the women kept saying how impressed she was with the facility.
I'm like, okay, I'm missing something. And she turned to me and said, you're missing it because you're thinking of this facility as a person. I said, you have issues with the aesthetics of it. The bears don't care about the aesthetics. They care that they've got 3/4 of an acre in there that they can dig and do anything they want out there like a real bear would.
But what really made Mooney a believer was when the Kinnears invited Sitka's 3rd through 5th graders out to the fortress. The Kinnears pitched 2 tents in the bear enclosure, and inside each was a sleeping bag with a hot dog in the bottom.
And the bears ran straight over to the tents, slit them open, pulled the sleeping bags out, ripped the hot dog out, and held the hot dog up and showed the kids. And the kids were like, I'm never taking food in my tent again.
Mooney was impressed. He spends a lot of his time on bear education, trying to train people to avoid the kinds of interactions that lead to dead bears and orphan cubs. In other words, the kind of situations that brought these bears to the fortress in the first place.
This just kills new. If you hold a mic up here, you can probably hear him breathe.
Kills new was the fortress's first bear. Mooney captured him as a cub in the summer of 2007, after his mother was shot trying to enter a lodge near Angoon.
He was malnourished, dehydrated, terrified, traumatized. He had all of the hair burn off his front paws, clear to the shoulders, a belly full of tapeworms, a mouth full of broken teeth. We started working with him right here in this training room. By the second day, we could hand feed him.
Kinnear says he understands why some folks object to the idea of the fortress. In an ideal world, brown bears shouldn't live in old clarifying tanks, he says. His grand vision for the fortress is much more ambitious. He wants to expand the habitats and eventually start rehabilitating bear cubs to return to the wild. This has been done in British Columbia and the lower 48, but isn't permitted in Alaska.
We aren't going to save a lot of bears. We've only done a dozen in the last, 10 years. Some of the other places around the country where they process and release, they're into the hundreds.
Mooney says releasing bears isn't likely anytime soon, but he says the fortress has a role even without that. He thinks these bears in captivity might turn out to be some of his best tools for keeping the rest of Sitka's bears wild. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholz.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to Whale Pass, a small community on Prince of Wales Island.
My name is Bob Meyer, and I've lived in Whale Pass for the last 7 years. The community of Whale Pass is ostensibly a retirement community, and it originated as a logging camp back in the 1960s. The properties are strung out along the edge of the bay and along the road system. It does not appear to be a cohesive village, if you would, but in spirit, it's a very tight community, as you would find in any other rural Alaskan setting. Everyone appreciates being close to nature, being out of the urban environments. During the summer months, fishing, crabbing, shrimping are the primary activities. During the winter time, hunting, snow machining, skiing would be the primary recreational activities. Indoor activities, we have a very strong community library association. We receive mail twice a week. That would be the other social points of the week. The area received its name by George Vancouver during their surveying. They observed a number of whales within Whale Pass and outside of Whale Pass. Primarily during the summer months, you'll see large numbers of humpback and killer whales, the occasional finback, but they're a rarity.
Bob Meyer lives in Whale Pass. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community on the show, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Rachel Walholtz, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jacqueline Estes and Lorelei Kanin in Anchorage, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, and Zachariah Hughes and Anna Rose MacArthur in Nome. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Josh Edge from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline is ready to help you succeed in your decision to quit tobacco. Take advantage of proven successful free resources. Trained quit coaches will provide support services to help you quit for good with confidential counseling. There's free nicotine replacement therapy and a tailored quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.